Unable to keep up with her in my heels, I stop to slip them off. My feet slap against the dirt path. Before my trip, I would have challenged anyone who told me I would be running barefoot through villages in India. Now, I can't imagine being anywhere else. The dry air whips through my hair as we pass through the village until we're on the outskirts of a neighboring one. We approach a small row of shops with tiled roofs and open fronts. A few people stare, but otherwise were ignored.
Here!
The girl opens the door to a shop more modern than the others. A blast of air conditioning hits us in the face as we enter. Inside the store, surrounded by lush decor, are glass-covered cases filled with 22-carat gold jewelry. Diamond studs and rings sit on top of the counter in revolving display holders with locks. A well-dressed man steps from behind the counter on our arrival.
Namaste. I am Sanjay, the owner of the store.
Hands folded, he bows slightly. Unlike many of the other villagers, he wears suit pants and a dress shirt. The top few buttons are undone, revealing a lightweight gold chain with an om pendant.
Namaste.
Smoke rises off burning incense inside a small makeshift temple.
Thank you for sending your daughter for me.
His face lights up at her mention.
The office is back here.
He leads me through a back door into a small room.
The gentleman on the phone asked for you by name.
He shuts the door to give me privacy. The musty room is overcrowded, with a small table and velvet-covered jewelry boxes stacked atop one another on the shelf next to an open container of pomegranate seeds. I lift the heavy receiver of the landline to my ear.
Hello?
When there's no answer, I repeat, Hello? Is anyone there?
Jaya?
Patrick's voice crackles over the static. Emotions slam into me. I had fought thoughts of him every day since my arrival. Now, I remember his warm breath against my neck as he held me at night. His excitement over new information that could influence a case he was working on, or his teasing laughter when I bought all the clothes for the baby. Suddenly, like running through a scene cut from a movie, I remember him finding me curled up on the bathroom floor after the first miscarriage. He picked me up and carried me to bed. There, we held each other as we cried. It was the first and last time we mourned our loss together.
Patrick! I grip the phone's wire. Can you hear me?
There's static, and then the phone goes dead. Disappointed, I lay my head back against the chair as memories fight their way to the surface. After the second miscarriage, I yearned to lean into Patrick, to pull him closer, and hope his strength would seep into me. But I never took the first step. Patrick stood by me as he shouldered his own grief. He shed the tears I couldn't. He mourned when my grief refused to give me a reprieve. His path to healing was to return to daily life. Each step he took only left me farther behind. At the end, I was standing alone with no answers on how to fill the void. But the past wasn't always littered with heartbreak. Before the miscarriages, our steps often matched each other's, and over the course of our courtship, we learned how to stand together. When we first moved in together, Patrick and I had a huge fight over which show to watch one night. At the time, it felt all-encompassing, as though we were fighting about all aspects of our relationship, not just a TV show. I feared we were headed for failure if we couldn't find a compromise. In the moment, I failed to remember all the hours we had spent together before, cuddling in his apartment or mine,
and watching television together. The fight ended with Patrick wrestling me to the ground and kissing me until I calmed down. That night, we spent hours making love. Lost in the past, I wonder now if Patrick is calling me to say we can still work it out, that somehow, in the midst of our heartbreak, he has found us a path back to happiness. I pick up the phone to call him back. My gold wedding ring, the one I haven't taken off, glistens on my finger. As I dial, I fiddle with it, turning it around and around. So many times I had thought to take it off, but with all the heartaches of the last few months, I needed an anchor, even if it was only in my head. The phone connects across the continents. I think about the last time we spoke and his admission about Stacy. I think of him holding her, kissing her. Bile rises in my throat. At his hello, I lay down the phone without saying a word. I close my eyes and wait for the pain to subside, and only then do I find my way home. Amisha, 25. Amisha was cleaning the desks. After each class, she made sure to tidy the room so the teachers wouldn't find cause to fault her. She'd started on the last desk when she heard someone behind her. "Merry Christmas," Stephen said when she turned around. He closed the door before setting a large bag down on the ground. "You're back!" Amisha rushed toward him and stopped inches away. "I am. Did you miss me?" he teased. He looked tired. His normally wrinkle-free clothes were disheveled and his tie was loose. There were circles beneath his eyes. "Yes." Amisha didn't care if it was inappropriate. Her friend was back, and she refused to lie to him. "I did. So very much." Amisha had missed him desperately. She passed the hours working with her students, but every time she approached the school grounds, her feet felt heavy and her mind lonely. She had missed their conversations and his company. During Stephen's absence, she had tried to talk to Deepak about some of the same topics she discussed with Stephen, but her husband had turned away, uninterested. Now, Stephen greeted her words with silence. His eyes searched hers. Sure, she had overstepped a boundary. Amisha, humiliated, took two steps back. "I'm sorry," she stammered, her enthusiasm disappearing. She started to tell him she had spoken out of turn when he interrupted her. "I forced my mother to stay up into the late hours of the night, talking about mundane topics." He closed the distance between them until she met his gaze. "It helped to pass the time until I returned." Amisha swallowed and then struggled to take the next breath. She heard the words he didn't say. They were the same ones she feared but would never give voice to. That even though their time apart was brief, they had missed each other more than friends do. He reached out until his hand was inches from hers. He waited, giving her the chance to say no, but she couldn't. She was desperate to feel the connection between them, if only for a moment. When he saw the agreement in her eyes, mixed with guilt, he nodded in understanding. He grasped her hand in his only for a second before releasing it. Amisha imagined Chada instructing her to walk away. Her mother-in-law would scream at her that in enjoying Stephen's company, she was bringing shame upon herself and her family. For just a moment, Amisha considered her options. Walking away was wisest, but for once, she wanted to keep her own counsel, to determine what was wrong and right when it harmed no one else. Questions that she would never have imagined asking now began to gnaw at her. And yet, ignoring them remained the only safe answer.
"Merry Christmas," Stephen said again, breaking the silence. He grabbed the bag by the door and held it out to her.
"I brought you a gift."
"What?"
Happy for the distraction, Amicia took the bag.
"You didn't have to."
The bag weighed heavy in her hands.
"I don't celebrate Christmas."
The last gift Amicia had been given was the jewelry from her dowry.
"Then I should take it back."
He moved to reclaim it, but she stepped away. Smiling, she held the bag close.
"It's mine," she whispered.
"Thank you." Amicia pulled out a package from inside the desk.
"Merry Christmas."
Hesitant, she held out the wrapped gift to him. After telling him about Navratri, she had asked him his favorite holiday. Without hesitation, he had told her about Christmas. When he mentioned presents, Amicia decided she would give him one. From the market, she had bought tissue paper and dyed it with saffron. With careful precision, she had wrapped her gift.
"This is for me?"
Stephen's eyes widened at the package she was thrusting at him.
"No, for me. I enjoy giving myself gifts," Amicia murmured, feeling at ease with him.
"You got me a gift," he repeated, taking it. She hadn't been sure how he would react, but his childlike joy was unexpected.
"Yes," she said, delighted she had followed her instinct.
"It's a tradition to shake a gift before you open it," Stephen said.
Amicia laughed when he did, and then, following his lead, shook the bag in a futile attempt to learn its contents. He laughed aloud.
"You're shaking it now. You're going to break it if you're not careful."
"Now?"
Amicia wasn't sure how it was done in his culture. She wondered if it was the same as hers, to open the gift and thank the giver profusely, or wait till you were in private and then send a thank you note.
"No, next Christmas," Stephen said. "When I'm all fighting in the war, you can send me a letter and tell me how you liked it."
His words echoed in her head. He was teasing, Amicia was certain, but her mind had already registered it. The last 2 weeks without him had been hard. She had missed him more than she thought imaginable, but the thought of never seeing him again left her reeling. Her next breath filled her lungs with dead air. He must have seen the change on her face, because the smile immediately disappeared off his.
"I'm joking, Amicia," he said quietly.
"I'm not going anywhere."
No matter how much he wants to, Amicia thought, but didn't say aloud. Nonetheless, she fought to hide the range of emotions she knew were dancing across her face. When tears pooled in her eyes, his filled with pain. She scolded herself for her inappropriate reaction and quickly shuttered her emotions. Instead, she offered him a forced smile while struggling to find her footing.
"Of course."
Feeling foolish, she murmured,
"Please accept my apology. I just..."
She stumbled over the words that tangled with her emotions.
"The war is dangerous, and you are my friend," she said, hoping the explanation sounded reasonable.
"Open the gift," he said softly,
offering her a reprieve. She gently loosened the strings and pulled out her present. A small seedling was sprouting in a soil-filled pot.
"A tree?"
Amicia stared at the gift in disbelief.
"From England," Stephen said. "It's a Fagus sylvatica, or European beech."
He smiled at her.
"It's native to England, considered the queen of British trees."
"How did you get it here?"
her small hands easily wrapped around the base of the pot.
I called in a favor.
He fingered the thick leaves, lobed like the palm of a hand.
It was delivered while I was traveling. I wanted to surprise you.
He paused, staring at the tree, and then at her.
I wanted to give you something from my home, for you to have here. It can live for over 1,000 years.
Long after you and I are gone. Amisha ran a finger over the leaf he had touched. She searched his face for the answer she already had. When he stayed silent, she said,
You have given me a wonderful gift, and I am indebted to you for bringing me such splendor.
There is no debt, but if there were, you would have already repaid it with your gift to me.
Stephen pulled on the string and tore at the paper until he revealed a small book. Amisha had written his name in perfect English letters on top, with hers, smaller, on the bottom. He glanced at her, but she simply smiled and motioned for him to open the cover. Inside, again, in precise letters, was a short tale set in England. Transfixed, Stephen took a seat and read aloud the words that flowed from the pages.
A man loses his brother. Inconsolable at the loss, the young man threatens the heavens with havoc unless he can see his brother one last time. When they do not respond, he begins to destroy things that the gods hold dear. Enough, the gods cry. Why do you want to speak to him?
To tell him something I didn't have the chance to, the young man says. He wanted to tell his brother the things in his heart, the things he is sure the brother does not know.
You will have 5 minutes, they say, agreeing. But in return, we get your voice. Agreed?
The young man quickly accepts the deal. When the lost brother comes forward and the young man starts to speak, the lost brother raises his hand for silence.
I already know, the lost brother says. I know you loved me.
He pauses, dropping his head as his emotions start to overwhelm him.
I always knew you respected me. Our memories will always be a part of you.
When the young man stares at his lost brother in shock, the lost brother starts to explain.
In my heart, he says, I've always known. We are brothers. Our hearts are the same.
By voicing what the young man was going to say, the lost brother ensured that his younger brother would keep his voice. They embrace, holding each other tight. When the gods deem their time is up, the lost brother starts to tear up at the word goodbye. It is now the young man who raises his hand to stop him.
Not goodbye, he says, shocking the lost brother, who is scared and alone.
Until we meet again.
And though he has lost his voice forever, the young man has given his brother the one thing he did not have. Hope. Amisha tried to finish cleaning, but kept glancing at Stephen to gauge his reaction. When he finally turned the last page, he looked up, his eyes holding hers.
How did you do this?
The story had come to Amisha the night after Stephen told her about his brother. When the holidays were approaching, Amisha decided to try her hand at the story. With it, she wanted to tell him that his brother knew how much he loved him. It took her weeks to put the simple story together, but she persisted. She wrote it at night after Deepak was asleep. Though she knew she was doing nothing wrong, she felt guilty for spending time on a gift for another man.
You like it?
More than you will ever know,
Stephen said, the words seeming to choke him. Amisha felt an unfamiliar lightness. Afraid she would say something and embarrass them both, she motioned toward the tree.
It is nothing compared to this. She cradled the pot. I want to plant it. May I?
Here? He seemed surprised. He ran his hand over his eyes, wiping away the moisture that had gathered.
I thought you would take it home.
I can't. Her gaze locked with his. It was the first time she had acknowledged that their interactions had to be kept secret. She saw understanding in his eyes and looked away, afraid of what it meant.
It belongs in our garden, she said, injecting a false note of brightness into her voice.
He took the plant from her, and together they walked to the garden. She searched for the perfect place and found a spot near their regular bench. Amisha began digging at the dirt with her hands. She was oblivious to the mud staining her cotton pants, her focus on providing his gift with the ideal place to grow its roots.
Here, let me help you.
Stephen found a small spade to spear the earth and then began digging. Once the hole was large enough, he rocked back on his heels and watched her. She gently removed the seedling from the pot and planted it in the spot. Stephen filled the hole, and both patted down the dirt with their hands to secure the tree.
Finished, Amisha said with satisfaction. Now the tree has a home.
Yes. Stephen stared down at the seedling that had only started to grow.
A place for you to come, years from now, and remember the time we spent here together.
Amisha. Stephen stood in the doorway of her empty classroom.
Could you come to my office, please? Nima's father is here, he said quietly. He wants to speak with us.
Nima had been absent for more than a week. Amisha had been concerned and even brought it up with Stephen, but he told her the school hadn't heard from the parents. Now, anxious to get more information, she walked quickly with Stephen to the office. He motioned her in first to the cramped space and then followed, shutting the door behind them.
This is Amisha, Stephen said, introducing them. She is Nima's teacher.
The Indian man clasped his hands together.
Namaste, he said.
Speaking to Amisha, he said,
As I was telling the lieutenant, Nima was hurt in an accident.
Is she all right? Amisha demanded, worried for the young girl.
I came to inform you that she will no longer be able to attend school.
The father didn't answer Amisha's question, but instead handed Stephen cash.
This should cover the remainder of my son's tuition for the year.
He started to leave, but then hesitated.
She spoke of your class often, Srimati, he said to Amisha. She enjoyed learning from you.
I have some of her old work. I would like to discuss with her, Amisha said, as he started to leave again. She felt Stephen's gaze sharpen, but concern for the girl overrode his disapproval.
Could I stop by to give some of my well wishes along with the work? That is not necessary, the father said immediately. I will pass on your good thoughts.
Thank you for coming, Stephen interjected, standing next to Amisha. Please, let us know if there is anything we can do for Nima. He walked the father out. When he returned, he found Amisha pacing his office. He started to speak, but Amisha interrupted him.
I know you're angry, but I had to try. It is not our place.
She started to protest, but he cut her off.
The school has to be very careful how it interacts with the students' families.
He rubbed the back of his neck, clearly frustrated with the situation and the circumstances surrounding it.
The Raj can't force Indians to send their children to our schools. If the parents feel we're using the children's attendance to police their family's home life, then they will pull their children out.
So, that's it?
Though the explanation made sense, Amisha was scared.
I'm sorry.
His face clearly showed he meant it. There's nothing we can do.
That's not good enough, Amisha said, worried about the young girl.
It has to be, Stephen replied.
I'm sorry. I know how much you cared for her.
Jaya. 26. When I was 16 years old, a neighbor down the street was diagnosed with cancer. It was a serious case with a poor prognosis, and he had an uphill battle ahead of him. The wife was a young mother with three children under the age of 5. The neighborhood set up a food schedule, and though my parents barely knew the family, my mom signed up and took dinners every other week. After the first few months, the dinner offerings slowed down and people got back to their lives. Around that time, my mother came home with a slew of cookbooks featuring American cuisine. Every night for the next few months, Mom tried a new recipe in lieu of her standard fare. Before serving dinner, she would deliver food for the family without leaving a note. She never talked about it at home or told anyone. The man recovered, and the family threw a gathering at its home to celebrate. At the party, the wife made a toast to the individual who had provided dinner every night. She had no idea who it was, and hoped the person would step forward. I glanced at my mother, who kept her face down and stared into her drink. The wife asked again, but there was only silence.
If anyone knows who they are, please tell them how very grateful I am, the woman finally said.
At home, later that night, Mom bid me good night and started for her room.
I'm surprised you didn't say something, I said. You could have gotten credit for all of your hard work.
At the time, it seemed to me she cared more about that family than she ever had for me. She learned to make meals they would like and took the steps to drop them off without being noticed. To the daughter, who had spent her life desperate for any show of affection, it was an opportunity lost. The family would certainly have shown her appreciation, gratitude, and acknowledgement.
It wasn't about me, she said quickly.
She shook her head and wrung her hands together.
It was about them and what they needed, that's all.
She left for bed, but I stared after her, wondering at the glimpse of fear I saw in her face at the thought of their learning the truth. I awoke this morning with thoughts of Patrick. When we dated, we rarely fought, but the few times we disagreed, we always talked it out. Never before would I have hung up on him, but those times are past. I hold up my hand and let the sun's ray glint off the gold ring. When he slipped it on my hand, we swore to love each other always. With my finger, I circle the band's diameter before slowly starting to slip it off. It stops at my knuckle and refuses to move. I tug at it, but it is stuck. Relieved, I push it back and jump out of bed. Once dressed, I follow the throng of people to an outdoor market. The streets are lined with cart vendors and talkative customers. I walk by each cart, admiring and assessing everything from fresh produce to books. I stop to admire a row of scarves.
I make it myself.
The young woman behind the wooden cart on wheels holds out a silk scarf. The elegant base red is delicately mixed with intricate patterns of light green and finished with a hem of indigo blue. It's the perfect gift for Mom to wear on cold nights. A similar shawl would cost more than $100 in America. 5 rupees.
After buying 3, I move to another cart where a young boy holds up soil-laden green and red peppers.
Fresh, see? No brown spots.
His long fingernails are packed with the black dirt, making me wonder if he picked the vegetables that morning.
You buy? Very good.
Yes, I buy. Tonight, I decide, I'll return the favor of Ravi's meals. I pick through the rest of his cart and choose ripe tomatoes and onions. When I finish paying for my goods, the woman in the next cart holds up a toy rattle.
For baby.
The woman, who has to be 90, gives me a toothless grin.
I have good toys.
Her cart is filled with cheap plastic toys and clay blocks. Each block is brightly painted with letters from the Indian alphabet.
No. No baby.
I move away just as she starts to try to convince me to buy. Other vendors are equally solicitous, each one motioning me toward his merchandise. Unable to resist, I purchase a sari for Mom and a silk shirt for Dad, along with various trinkets. There was a time when I never would have bought trinkets and teased any friends who did. I always insisted that cheap stuff was a waste of money. Now, I think of Nima, my grandmother, and all the other people who were just trying to live their lives as best they could. If not for circumstance, I could be in their position. Out of habit, I start to ask for a shirt for Patrick before stopping myself. Angry at my near mistake, I start to chastise myself when Roki comes out of nowhere and jumps on me, nearly knocking me down.
You either do not like my meals, or you're going to cook for me, Ravi says, a few steps behind the dog.
I love your meals, but I am going to cook you dinner. Jarred from my malaise, I hug Roki as he lavishes me with licks. I've been shopping. I hold up my full basket proudly.
I see that, and I am nearly blind.
He peruses the contents and then asks me what I paid. When I tell him, he lets out a hearty laugh.
You have funded our village for the next 6 months.
Their presents for home, he smiles at me.
You have the same stubborn look your grandmother had.
He leans heavily on his cane.
It is good you paid so much. No price is too high for a gift from your heart.
We pass the rest of the vendors as Ravi takes us on a roundabout path toward home.
Come, I shall show you where I live. You can cook for me there.
As we leave the market and head toward his neighborhood, the homes get smaller and more dilapidated. We turn into a narrow alley that is barely 5 feet wide. Wet mud and cow dung line the streets. Gutters carved into the side of the road are clogged with mango peels and roti. A pack of stray dogs scavenges through a pile of garbage in search of food. With every step, I process the level of poverty I have heard of but never seen. The children running through the streets barely have any clothes on. Their bodies are bone thin, and their faces seem older than their age. Stress lines their faces. In my own childhood, I never worried about finding my next meal or having a safe roof over my head. What I took for granted would be a luxury for these children. Ravi stops in front of a hovel in the middle of these slums. His home is attached to others in a long row. The roof is broken in places, and brown water drips off the corner and onto the street.
Home.
He holds open the worn door with pride.
Welcome.
I flinch as I take in the dirt floor and grimy walls that make up 2 small rooms of his home. A third room, a kitchen, has a kerosene stove on the floor and a pot filled with dirty dishes.
Ravi, this is...
I search for the appropriate words so as not to insult him,
but fail. This is where you live?
My childhood home and my apartment in New York are mansions in comparison. I ache for him, but cover my reaction so I don't offend him.
And I welcome you in it, he says.
Ravi fills an old cup with water from a bucket and pours it into Roki's bowl. We both watch Roki lap it up before he saunters toward his blanket on the floor. He stretches before settling himself down for a nap.
When did you get him?
10 years ago, Ravi says. I was walking into the village one day. He was walking the same way. We have been together ever since.
I smile at the simplicity of the bond. Both Ravi and his dog are content in their humble home, and yet I struggle to understand it. I have always taken my material trappings for granted, but now, seeing Ravi's pride in the little that he has, I'm ashamed to admit that I can't remember a time when I fully appreciated them. Disappointment at never having demanded better of myself washes over me.
Why don't you live in my grandmother's house? I finally ask.
A mouse scurries along the thin wall before disappearing into a small hole in the corner. Roki wakes up to let out a ferocious bark at the mouse before settling back to sleep.
It belongs to your family. Besides, my friends would miss me.
He gestures to where the mouse ran into the hole.
They rely on me to provide them with their food.
Where is your family?
I remember he mentioned a grandson the day we met.
My son and his wife live with my grandson and his family. They are not far from here.
Ravi slips his sandals off and rubs the soles of his feet.
My son's wife is a daughter to me.
He smiles to himself.
I am blessed that fate was so generous. She wants me to live with them so they can show their concern for me. And each time I tell her, not yet, daughter, not yet.
Why? Confused, I ask. They could take care of you.
Yes, but then who would take care of Amisha's home and gardens?
He asks gently. He gestures toward his home.
I am happy here.
Your wife?
The house lacks the attention of a woman. An oil lamp sits in the corner, and a torn afghan is spread over a mattress on the floor. 3 pairs of outfits, similar to the one Ravi is wearing, are folded neatly and placed next to the bed.
It's hard to remember all the clothes I discarded over the years, something being out of fashion, having a lost button, or simply seeming worn were just some of the excuses I used to update my wardrobe. In contrast, Ravi treats the little he has with care.
I spread her ashes in the river years ago.
He removes his glasses and rubs a hand over the sadness on his face.
We cremated a son before that. He died at 3.
He warms his hands over the oil lamp. Though the sun is high and its rays powerful, I fight a chill of fear watching him.
Are you all right?
There is not enough skin on these bones, my son tells me.
He blows on his warm hands.
I laugh, but when I feel the cold in the heat of the day, I must admit, he may be right.
Have you seen a doctor? I ask, worried. Even though we have known each other only a short while, it feels like much longer.
Maybe because of the story or the time we are spending together, I have come to care for him. He smiles, telling me without words he appreciates my concern.
I made a promise to your grandmother. There is no disease that can take me until I have fulfilled it.
He stares over my head, and his eyes glaze over. I wonder if he's imagining my grandmother again.
Then, when it is my time, Even the best of health will not save me. He shakes his head and seems to come out of his malaise. So, I will enjoy your meal tonight and may even take seconds. I'm not a good cook, I say, touched by his declaration. Then I will savor it even more, for neither was your grandmother. This assures me that you are truly her own.
I wash the vegetables in an old colander while Ravi lights the portable kerosene stove. Once they're washed, I slice the vegetables and toss them into the pan. Ravi follows them with pinches of various spices he adds to the mixture from unmarked containers. What are they? I ask. The spices look the same as those I have seen my mother use over the years.
Mustard seeds.
He picks up a handful of small black seeds and then points to a red powder.
Chili pepper? And this?
He holds up a yellow powder.
Is turmeric.
He smashes a clove of garlic and ginger and stirs the pieces into the pot, followed by chopped onion. They start to sizzle with the rest of the food.
Satisfied, he says, it will be ready soon.
I'm so glad you let me cook for you, I tease. The smell from the spices fills the room and makes my mouth water. I never thought before about things like a refrigerator or clean water. Now I wonder if I'll ever think of them in the same way.
Your mother never taught you.
As a child, I used to watch my mom cook. She seemed happiest when lost in creating meals. But whenever I asked to help, she shooed me away, told me to find something else to do. No, she liked to cook alone. But her love of cooking had to come from somewhere. My mother is an exceptional cook. Who taught her? He pauses, his hand still going on the pot he was readying to put away.
Her stepmother, he says quietly. She insisted your mother learn.
Out of tradition, or? I ask, hoping he says yes. Ravi shakes his head no.
She required Lena to make the family's three meals every day.
She still does. There was never a meal not perfectly cooked or presented. I assumed it was her joy, but now disappointment sweeps over me. Every day she cooks.
Did your husband cook?
He asks when I don't say more. No. I appreciate his attempt to change the topic. My husband? Ex-husband, I correct, then stop. I shift in my seat, feeling a knot ravel in my stomach. It is the first time I have called him that. I take a deep breath and pinch the bridge of my nose as I try to remember his question. We usually ate out, I finally answer.
You are divorced?
Ravi asks gently, seeing my reaction. Soon to be. My head hurts as I think of the last few years. We faced a lot of loss during our marriage. Darkness starts to swirl around me. It's been a few days since the last episode of Losing Time. With the reprieve, I had hoped it was over. It proved stronger than us. I close my eyes, too weak to fight it.
Jaya?
Ravi asks. When I open my eyes, he's standing in front of me. From the concern on his face, I know I blacked out again. I'm sorry, I whisper, hating the loss of control. It seems to happen every time I think of Patrick or the babies. I lost myself for a minute there. When he continues to watch me with concern, I try to allay his worry. I'm fine, I promise. I think sometimes my mind needs a break.
Coming to India? Ravi asks gently. It has helped you to forget?
Maybe. The letter was the perfect excuse. I remember his earlier words about my uncle's. At the time, getting away seemed smarter than staying.
Sometimes it is the wisest answer.
He gestures for me to take a seat across from him on the floor.
Let us eat your meal.
27. Feeling like a native, I walk past rows of mud-clustered walls with little space between them. Women are busy in their front yards, beating water out of washed clothes or bathing their screaming infants in buckets. Around us, birds sing in unison with the ox carts that creak by. The men, mostly topless, whip the animals to move faster under the boiling sun. A stray dog barks at me, but loses interest when a young boy tosses a lump of dripping mango peels in the dung-lined street. I watch all of it, amazed at the human mind and ability to make a home no matter the circumstances. These children, surviving with so little, are more resilient than I can ever hope to be. The property and tax office is located one village over. The Indian flag waves atop a large pole. Half-naked children run through a sprinkler system in the front yard, though there is little grass to water. Inside the office, three rotating table fans flutter the papers stacked on the desks. The office is cramped, with barely enough room to walk. A black-and-white picture of Mahatma Gandhi hangs on the wall. A uniformed man and woman are working with files. Another man, dressed in a similar brown top and shorts, asks me if I need assistance. I'm here about the house, mill, and school properties. I offer him my passport to verify my identity. I'm the granddaughter of the deceased owner. He pulls a file and shifts through it.
Your uncles relinquished their rights to the house and mill. Your mother is the sole owner, he says after verifying my identity.
He hands me the official paperwork that includes the letters from all three brothers. I read through their letters and the rest of the file. He pulls out one final letter and hands it to me.
We received this a week ago. Your mother has no interest in the properties.
What? I take the letter and read through Mom's two sentences, giving up all her rights to the properties. She instructs the government to do with them whatever they wish.
We will now sell the properties to the highest bidder, he explains when I look up. It is good news. The mill can once again make grain. Local contractors will lease the school. Your grandfather always refused.
The man hands me various offers from local businesses. I take them all with shaking hands.
You will receive a healthy return.
Why didn't my grandfather sell the school? I ask, hoping this man can give me answers.
He said it was not his to sell.
The man's confusion matches mine.
It sat there, unattended for years, but every time he refused.
I envision my grandmother's garden and how she found herself within its splendor. The mill had provided my mother and grandmother with sustenance while they lived in the village. My own history is intertwined with theirs, even though I am just now discovering it. I run my thumb over the letters that burn in my lap. I still have no idea what happened to my mother or what would cause her three siblings to relinquish their rights, but every part of me senses that the school and house are as essential to the story as the people who spent time in them. Though unsure what I will do with the properties, I know there is only one decision I can make. We've changed our minds. We're not selling. I'm here to claim the properties, to keep them in the family. Ravi. I knock on his door and wait. I had promised him I would come by after visiting the property office. A boy, taller than me, opens the door. He's in the same uniform I've seen the village children wear to school, a white top over brown shorts with ankle-length socks. Wire-rimmed glasses cover his deep-set eyes. Namaste. I glance over his shoulder into the house. Is Ravi home?
You are my great-grandfather's guest from America.
At my nod, his young face lights up.
I am Amit, his great-grandson.
His English is formal, with each word clearly enunciated.
My great-grandfather speaks of you often. It is a pleasure to meet you. You live a few villages over, I ask, remembering Ravi mentioning it.
Yes, he motions me into the house.
Can I offer you some water or cane sugar juice? I will go to the market for it now.
No, please. I stop him with a hand on his, touched by his nervousness. Water would be wonderful, thank you. He uses a ladle to fill a glass from the boiled pot.
You just returned from school?
Yes. I come as often as possible to check on Dada, he says, using the Indian word for grandfather.
He sits cross-legged on the floor while offering me a folded chair. I join him instead, folding my legs beneath me. Though his face shows surprise, he says nothing.
What grade are you in? I ask, while sipping the lukewarm water.
8th. A blush spreads across his cheeks. They moved me up a grade because of my test scores.
He fiddles with the strings of the rug we're sitting on.
Do you like India?
Yes, very much. Though my leaving for India was an excuse to run away, I have since learned about the women who came before me. Understanding each event, each detail that shaped their lives, is helping me to better understand mine. I once interviewed a New Age guru who spoke about how unfinished business from ancestors can trickle down to generations twice, even 3 times removed. Actions in the present can help to correct the mistakes made in the past. And even if there is no absolution to be had, an understanding may help keep the same mistake from being repeated.
Your Ravi Dada has been kind to me, I say. He told me once that people will forget many things, but they will never forget a person who shows them kindness.
He is a very smart man, I say, sure that Ravi had been talking about my grandmother.
Maybe you take after him? I would be blessed if that was true.
He uses the bottom of his shirt to clean Ravi's extra pair of glasses.
How many children do you have?
Though the reminder stings, I take no offense at his innocent question. All over the village, women my age are mothering 3 to 4 children. One will be draped over her, while others follow on foot. I am not as blessed as your Ravi Dada to have a lovely child like you in my life.
That is very charitable of you to say.
Amit stands after checking the time on the small watch on his wrist.
I must go. My sister...
He pauses, shuffling his feet.
She has trouble carrying her books.
I rinse out our glasses while Amit gathers his things. I watch him leave, making note to ask Ravi more about his great-grandchildren.
I've decided to keep the properties.
I hold the phone close to my ear.
I don't want them, Jaya. They don't matter to me.
I start to tell her how much they mean when she says,
I don't want them to hold you there.
Suddenly I understand. She sent the letter relinquishing her rights to bring me home. Not wanting to argue with her, I change the subject.
Your mother wrote stories, constantly. Though I never gravitated toward fiction before, now I yearn to read Amisha's tales. She was desperate to write in English. She taught at an English school in exchange for lessons from a member of the Raj.
Was she...
Mom pauses, and I can hear her struggling with the information. I wait patiently as she finds her voice.
Happy?
It's the same question Ravi asked about Mom. I think so. In the story, her children were her greatest source of joy. In spite of the struggles of the time, she never lost sight of what was important. She was strong. You would have been proud of her. Mom takes an audible breath, and then there's silence. I continue telling her about the mother she never knew. She had a garden. It's beautiful, filled with every flower you can imagine, and a beech tree from England. She spent so much of her time in it while she was learning English.
Why is he telling you this story? She whispers. Why tell you all these things?
I think it has to do with what your father wanted to give you. When she stays silent, I ask, you still don't want to know?
No story is going to change what happened.
Something in the way she says it catches my attention. What happened, Mom? There's a hitch in her voice, a sound of sorrow that has no definition. Mom!
Please come home.
At the sound of her crying, I fight my own tears.
There are things I have never told you.
Then tell me now, I beg. Around me, the cafe's noise fades until the noise in my own head drowns it out.
What are you hiding? Some secrets, Jaya, she says quietly, are meant to stay hidden.
Unbidden, I think of Patrick. Our marriage seemed an open book until we started trying to have a child. At the same time, my own counsel felt sounder than Patrick's or advice from doctors. I was sure I knew the right steps, the best path toward our goal. I didn't hear him, because I didn't want to. When our marriage fell apart and he turned to Stacy, I was sure he was at fault. Now, I think of how much I kept from him, my fears, my hurts, and the emptiness that crowded everything and everyone else out. It felt safest to keep it from him. How could I explain to him my desperate need to have a child and my sense of failure when I could barely understand them myself? No, Mom, I say, surprising myself. They aren't. Your fears are telling you what you want to hear, but they're hurting you more than helping.
Is that why you're in India, Jaya?
She asks softly.
Because you're facing your fears? Or are you running from them?
I try to see past her words, to the desperation to bring me home. I'm running from them. Her intake of breath tells me I've surprised us both by my admission. I want to tell her that because of the story, I'm feeling better, that every day doesn't feel like a burden to be carried. There are even moments, lost in the story, when I forget about the ache that has taken a permanent place in me. I don't know what else to do. When Patrick and I broke up, it felt like there was nothing left of me.
He called here to ask about you,
she says softly. The part of me that wants to hold on to belief is overridden by facts and logic. Patrick has moved on with Stacy, and in time my heart and mind will have to accept it. The wedding ring I still cannot take off weighs heavy on my finger. He called here too. I don't tell her that it was probably tying up loose ends, that Stacy might be pushing him so they have the freedom to move forward. We're both moving on, I lie. He was my first love, and it is hard